Ron Sorrow a long time ago on another planet far, far away, about the same timeline though. He was working for Rankus Hines as a instructor for the EASE program, which if you don't know is what's the spice
difficult.
For rooms?
Difficult.
Difficult, yes. They had just introduced a new module called EARS, which allowed you to auralize a inputted room. And maybe in one of the uses I saw was proving to a client that where they intended to put the sound console was the wrong place. Anyway, so now we'll fast forward to today. And Ron has taken over the abandoned power plant at SATSUP, which fortunately for him was never energized or commissioned, so it's not radioactive. And he uses it for acoustic testing. I'll let him explain all of that. In a past life, he's a musician, played in early forms of the Santana Band, the Doobie Brothers, and a one-hit wonder called the
Rivieras,
out of South Bend, singing about girls and the California sun. What?
South Bend,
Indiana. Yes.
Akron, Ohio.
Anyway, without any further delay, Ron Sorrow.
Alrighty. Thank you. Just real quick, just a quick show of hands. I've been around for a long time, so it's easier for me to kind of go through the early part of my presentation if I know how many know me or have known about me in the last few years. Okay. Then it'll make it a lot faster to go through, that's all. Because what I'm going to be doing here is I've been doing papers and strictly working in acoustics for about the last 12, 13 years now. And because of that, I got kind of out of the AES thing because I wasn't designing sound systems anymore and I wasn't installing sound systems or designing any of the recording studios or anything like that anymore for many years. And I got involved in strictly the acoustics part of it. And in doing so, I ended up getting almost all my papers at AES and INS and places like that, and yay, very few here. What I found was a lot of our discoveries never got beyond AES and INS. They just got stuck there. So a lot of our acoustic work for the last 10 years has kind of disappeared, even though this is stuff that you guys would use for design work almost every day. And it just doesn't make sense to me that I don't at least do something. So what I'm doing right now is I'm kind of collapsing 10 years worth of papers into a 2.5 hour period here. So if it sounds like I'm kind of rushing along, I am, okay? This presentation that we're gonna be looking at right now is 10 years of PowerPoint presentations collapsed into one. So it's as you can see here, it says old problems, new solutions, architectural acoustics in flux redux, okay? There's a reason why it's redux.
May we ask questions?
Yes.
As you go through your presentation?
Yes. Yes.
That you originally gave it ASA and not AES. You said AES. I'm sorry.
Gotcha. Sorry about that. It's a long day, so.
Sorry.
So yes, it was ASA and not AES. But in any case, the reason it's redux is because I noticed after I put it together and titled it that I'd already given this particular title about 3 years ago at ASA. So it was like, okay, we're going to just go on from that point on. So first thing is, I'm Ron Sorrow. I'm the president of NWA Labs, the previous president of Northwest Audio and Acoustics. And before that, Ron's Keyboard and Electronic Services, which we are the largest service company west of the Mississippi for 25 years. And before that, Ron's Organ Service. And before that, the U.S. Air Force. And before that, we played music for a group called The Entertainers and for people like Santana, Dionne Warwick, a bunch of other groups. So here we are. We're going to go right back to the beginning of this because this indicates why I'm here. As a young boy, high school physics class, I built the first atom smasher electronic accelerator that was built in the U.S. by somebody that was not the U.S. government. And I did it as a science fair project. And what was interesting is my teacher told me I would never make it as a scientist because I couldn't do the writing part of it. And I told him before I left class, you know, if I need to do writing, I just hire somebody. I can do the research. I don't need to do the writing. That was a bad thing to do. So same year, I joined the Air Force, and we were doing search and rescue for Civil Air Patrol. I don't know how many know Civil Air Patrols. And I was in an airplane, and it went down going into the mountains. By the way, the mountains of Ohio, which consists of, you know, 150-foot hills, okay? So it went down. The guy I was flying with died in it. I walked away. In 63, just before I joined the service, me and three friends formed a group called the Rivieras, and we recorded a million seller that year called California Sun. And to give you an idea of how old this is and how many years ago it is, there were two gold records that year, and only two. It was on a 45. The other record was called, any guesses, 63? Louie Louie. So that gives you at least an idea how old I am. I volunteered to join the Air Force in 64. This is before the Vietnam War started. I went to base technician at Keesler for radar maintenance, and got assigned to Vietnam at Da Nang, and was there when the Gulf of Tonkin happened. The day the Gulf of Tonkin happened, the four of us were walking down the street. A sniper took the other three guys out and missed me when the guy pushed me and got me in the chin instead. So during that 4 years of the Air Force, I also drove a car off a cliff down by Cambria, California, and drove another one off a cliff down just south of San Pedro. So that was the radar site I was on. If you look carefully up here, you will see a very thin guy. That was me back in those days. And that was me right there also playing my quartervox. I've been playing quartervox and accordion since I was 4 years old. And anytime you hear an organ in any of my recordings, it sounds like a B3, that's the quartervox. So that's what the whole idea was. So upon my discharge of the Air Force, I went to work as a technician for NASA at Ames Research Center. And because of the shortage, and by the way, this was a really weird period of time. If you didn't live during this period, you might not understand how it worked. But back then, the hippies believed that you didn't need to have science and math or anything else in order to exist. That was external to what we needed to know. The only thing you needed to know was how to build macrame and how to farm, and basically we had nothing to do with science. So therefore, at Berkeley that year, they only graduated 7 scientists and 2 mathematicians. And this was the heart of the Apollo mission period. And NASA was going nuts trying to figure out how to find enough scientists, and they couldn't. We went to MIT, went to a number of places, and couldn't get enough people to hire. So in order to do that, they sent all their top technicians to a competition. We took classes and tests, and the top 2 technicians in each center was sent to Ames Research to go into a 1-year class at Stanford. And the 1-year class consisted of basically 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, of nothing but science and math necessary to become a physicist, an engineer, and by the way, there are 2 different types of engineering. We all had to select one type that we wanted, one type they needed. So in my case, I got my physics, the equivalent of physics degree, my electronics engineering degree, and my mechanical engineering degree, all inside a 1-year period. Needless to say, at the end of it, I felt like I could do anything, even though I wasn't sure about that. So as a result of the first airline hijacking, D.B. Cooper, if you remember, we were tasked with inventing some way of detecting guns. So my specialty was low-field magnetics. And what we ended up doing was inventing a little gate you walk through, which consisted of a magnetic probe in the upright position, a second one in a down position, and going to a comparator. And if you walk through, you just jotted one or the other, slip the comparator over, and chink, you have a little red light. That was it. How good was it? It was a magnetic detector. So therefore, if the gun was not steel or iron, you couldn't see it. So you could make a gun out of brass or stainless steel or almost anything and walk right through it. And I have loved going to airports the last 25 years with a wad of keys about the size of my fist, all made out of copper and brass, and walking through without emptying my pocket. And then at the end of it, pulling them out and going, needless to say, the TSA is not real fun with me. So at least it gives you an idea. This is what our first invention was. And again, this is the only picture in my life where as a scientist, I wore a white lab coat. Okay? I don't know how many of you know what scientists are, but my wife has learned. Okay? She married me 15 years ago, she came out of college, and she worked with scientists, and they all had white lab coats. I met her, and she came out here, and I took her to my first place I worked at, and I wore exactly what I'm wearing now. And she looked at me and she says, "You're not dressed like a scientist." And I said, "Wait till you find out what science really is." And at the end of about 3 weeks of being around me, she said, "I figured out being a scientist is really easy. It's a blue-collar job with math."
Yep.
And that's really what it is. So I invented something here that is going to look familiar in a few minutes. If you look at it very carefully, there are these little probes hanging all around. Okay? These are magnetic probes. In 1968, we had to measure the radioisotope generators for the Pioneers 10, 11, and Voyagers 1 and 2. These are radioactive generators. They have no shielding. They have no temperature control. They run at 500 degrees C, and they put out an enormous amount of radiation. And in the original facilities that I was in, you had to walk up to that turntable and turn it by hand, and then flip. Needless to say, at being 23 years old, I wasn't anxious to go turn a radioactive generator every time I had to move it around. So one of my jobs was to invent a way of measuring the magnetic field three-dimensionally and turn it automatically. Now, guys, today you go buy the equipment. 1968, we had to invent something that didn't exist. Number one, we didn't have integrated circuits. Okay, they didn't exist yet. We had transistors, but we didn't have integrated circuits. And the other thing we didn't have was we didn't have control systems and we didn't have data acquisition systems because that all came out of later stuff. Okay, so to give you an idea, the very first A to D converter was invented during this period. And it came from Fairchild. It was 16-bit A to D. And it cost $24,000 for a single chip. Okay? This is how ancient we are. If we wanted to build a NOR or an OR gate, you went and you got a card about this big, and you stuffed it with about 10 transistors, resistors, capacitors, and all the parts necessary to create an OR gate. And then you stuck the card in a card folder, and then you wire wrap the back of it to form another gate to go to another thing. So we're talking about ancient days when we did get some kind of integrated circuit, which also happened during this period. They were RTL. Okay, so I don't know how many of you ever dealt with RTL, but TTL did not exist yet. Okay.
There was DTL.
Huh?
There was DTL.
Yeah, right. DTL. So what you're looking at here is a two positions of the radioisotope generator for the two things along with the probes. So this was an arc that we invented. Now, the bad thing about the arc was magnetometers at that time cost $30,000 per instrument, per thing. And we didn't have that kind of budget, and we only had the order came down from up above. We had to launch Pioneer 10, 11 to go to Jupiter and Saturn. And when they told us, you know, we had to measure this thing, they said, "You have 75 days to do everything you need to do and get it on the launch pad." And my comment was, the technology doesn't exist to measure it yet. And their comment is, 75 days. That was it, okay? And I said, well, can't we extend it to 80 or 85? He said, no, because the launch window only comes every 75 years. And that takes the launch window to work from. So what you see over there are magnetometers that had never been invented previously. They all were these big monster machines, and they were tubes. They weren't even transistors. So we had to invent a magnetometer that did the same thing with a probe that cost $10 instead of $25,000. So what you see here is the lunar surface magnetometer. As part of our investigation, my specialty was low field magnetics. And the problem was there were only three of us at NASA, total. Two at Goddard and me at Ames. So what you're looking at right now is the lunar surface magnetometer packed up, ready to go to the moon on Apollo 11. And that is the actual magnetometer that is on the moon, which you see in the next picture next to it. Okay? These are the magnetometers for the Pioneers 10 and 11, which were the first satellites to go past Jupiter and Saturn, and the first ones to go out of the solar system, in spite of the fact they keep telling you Voyager 1 and 2 are. Okay? This is the Voyager, and that's our magnetometers here, right here at the very end. So, as you can see, by the way, this, even though these were part of the little plaque that went on it, they are also to scale. So that's how big these satellites were. They're really quite large. So about 1971, I was on my way to work, living in the Bay Area, and because of traffic jam, I missed a flight. I flew on board a CV-990. Anybody know what that is? Convair? It's equivalent to a DC-8, a little typical small airplane that people flew in, okay, or large airliner at that time. So I missed the flight, and on the way back in for landing that afternoon, we were working out of Moffett Field. Anybody know where that is? Okay, they had two parallel runways. They flew P-3 Orions out of that for the Navy. And on the way in, we were down at the end of the runway waiting to get the stuff off the airplane. And we noticed the two airplanes coming in side by side. One was a jet and the other is a prop airplane. And next thing we know, the prop airplane drops under the jet. And they're coming down, coming down, coming down. They're about 50 feet off the ground. And all of a sudden, the prop airplane pulls up like this in front of the jet. And the jet hits it right at the base of the tail, flips it up on top of itself, and they both drop down on the golf course right at the 101 freeway. So, I mean, if you know anything about that area, you got the 101 freeway, you got the golf course on this side of it, and you got Moffett Field on this side. And this is at 4 o'clock in the afternoon at rush hour. So it was all bumper to bumper. Both airplanes came down within 10 feet of the fence, and both caught fire. And everybody inside perished in the fire, not in the crash, because they were only a few feet off the ground. And they were all my friends, and these people I flew with every day for a year and a half, except that day. My best friend had gotten married the night before, and he flew in my place because I didn't show up. And I had to go tell his wife that she was a widow after one day of being married. So needless to say, I left NASA because they took what was left of the two airplanes and put it in the junkyard, and my office looked out over the junkyard. So it was like, okay, that's it. I walked away and went back on the road playing music, and I played music for about 10 years on the road. And I got tired of living on the road after 10 years and traveling everywhere, and settled down and opened up my electronics repair facility for musical instruments. And then I started, I went to the very first class at Yamaha on sound system design. And I learned something about sound system design, which makes you nervous, makes you, you know, you think you know everything by that time. And so I learned that two speakers on either side probably is not a great thing if you're doing mono work. okay? Learned little things like that. And as time got on, I did a few more. I figured out more things, what I was doing wrong, et cetera. And I got involved with ease. By sheer accident, I went down to one of the shows, and I saw three booths side by side. You had CAD P2, you had Acousti-CAD, and you had Ease. And Bose, yeah, Bose Modeler, I forgot, okay? So I went to Bose Modeler first, and I found out the price of the package was $300, and that was the best price of any of them. So I thought about doing that until I found out they only had Bose speakers. And I didn't want to do Bose speakers. So I went next door, and I talked to the guys at CAD P2, and found out that I was ready to buy them. They were $500, and the only problem was it only had JBL speakers. And then I went to Acousti-CAD next door, and found out they only had EV speakers in it. And finally, I got down to the next last booth, and there was a guy that said he had Ease, and he had this huge speaker base of a whole bunch of different speakers, but it was $1,000 for Ease Junior. So I sat there and I thought, okay. So I bought Ease Junior, took it home, built my first model. And by the way, this is Ease One, which consisted of you typed in numbers for X, Y, Z coordinates, and you went to the next one and said P2, X, Y, Z, P3, X, Y, Z. And after you finished typing all these numbers in, you pushed a button, and a single picture came up that you couldn't move. It was just one view, 3D view, period. There was no zooming. There was nothing. There was just a view of the building. And it was like, okay, I learned how to do a basic building. So I went, my second building was the Rialto Theater in Tacoma. Okay, this means a balcony, this means a curved top and everything else. And this was also a program that consisted of DOS. So everything had to fit in 640K in memory. Remember those days? Okay, that meant I had a maximum of 300 faces in Ease that was available to me, which was a lot because nobody ever built anything over 100 faces total. So I built the Rialto Theater, not knowing that you couldn't do it. And I built the entire thing, and it took a little over around 300-400 faces. And in the middle of it, I calculated what the RT60 was, and then I calculated by hand because, you know, being the ex-NASA guy, I don't trust computers as far as I can throw them, basically, because that's what you did with them. Okay, you got to remember when we landed on the moon, our landing computer consisted of a 4-bit computer with 1K of memory that ran at 10K hertz. And it only could have two variables in it. That's why when they were landing, it gave this alarm, is because it had X, Y, and Z. It didn't like X, Y. It did okay with X, Y. It didn't like Z. And that's why Armstrong had to land by hand. But the facts were that I called up Rinkus, and I said, Rinkus, I said, when I calculate the RT60, it doesn't come anywhere close to what it actually should be because I calculated by hand. And he said, what did you do? And I said, well, you put windows on here, which, you know, you did with it, lay it on the code. Well, yeah, you can't do that. You have to build it into the wall. And I said, well, in that case, and you'll have 15 million different faces just to make a window up. You know, and he said, well, he said, it still shouldn't calculate the RT60 wrong. And I said, well, here it is. And he said, would you send me the folder? And I sent him the folder. And by the way, this was the days where if you wanted to talk to anybody or do anything, you had to send them the file on a disk because there was no internet. There was none of this kind of stuff. So I sent them the file, and I got a phone call about 2 days later and said, yeah, it's not right. And I said, so what are you going to do about it? And he says, well, I'm going to send it to Wolfgang. And I said, who's Wolfgang? And he said, well, he's the writer of the program in Germany. And I said, okay. So he sent it off, DHL. Got it. 3 o'clock in the morning, my phone rings. And I pick it up, and I kind of, okay. He says, is this Ron Sorrow? And I said, yeah, it is. He says, this is Wolfgang Honertz. And I'm kind of going, who? And he says, Wolfgang Honertz. I says, okay, so who are you? And he says, I'm the writer of Ease. And I'm kind of going, oh, okay. I said, you know it's 3 o'clock in the morning here? He says, it is almost 6 o'clock here. And I'm kind of going, well, that's nice, but it's 3 o'clock here. Or I'm sorry, noon. and he says, so you're saying that I'm wrong in my program. He says, who are you? I says, just a guy who calculated it by hand. And he says, And I got this silent treatment for about 30 seconds or so. And he says, you're right. And I said, okay. I says, so what does that do me? He says, I'm sending you a new disk with a new program with a change in it. And I said, okay, great. He said, have you ever thought about beta testing? And I'm kind of going, not really. He said, how would you like to be the beta tester for Ease? And I'm kind of going, sure, what does that get me? And he says, how about a free version of Ease? And I'm kind of going, are we talking about Ease Junior? He says, no, Ease. And I'm kind of going, well, that's $1,700. Yeah, I could do that. So I became the official beta tester for Ease in 1989, and I was the only beta tester until 1994 when I brought Bruce Olson on, and then brought him in to 94, actually 95, when we went to Windows 95. But the facts were that he brought me in because we found problems with Ease that he didn't even recognize. And the reason he didn't is he didn't build models the same way I did. He built them a certain way, and that's how he tested them. And somebody else built it differently. He was like, why would you do that? Well, it makes sense. Okay. So that's how I ended up getting involved in Ease. And after working with Ease for many, many years, worked on projects of every kind you can imagine, including a lot of things that nobody imagined. Eventually, I figured out that the acoustics affects the sound system more than anything else does. You know, everybody says, well, you got to put good speakers in. I found out you can have the greatest speakers in the world in a lousy room, and it will still sound lousy. And you can have some of the worst speakers in the world and put them in a great room, and anything will sound good. You know, so I learned that acoustics was where it was going to be, had to be, so I then moved myself into affecting the acoustics part of it. And what I discovered was the databases were the major problem with these things. The theory behind it was actually pretty well thought out. So you could actually calculate RT60 and calculate this and everything else. But if you didn't have a good database and good data to begin with, it made no difference how good you were, because you're going to get a wrong answer no matter what you did. So I thought back to my NASA days, and I thought I can convert a 68 eventually. Remember that little arc? There is the new version of it on the right side. As you can see, the scale is considerably different. Okay, this one that was on the left side was 1 meter. This is 4.5 meters from here to here. Okay, and then it sits 15 feet in the air. So from here to here is approximately 35, almost 40 feet. Needless to say, this gives me pretty much a free field, especially when you're inside of a building that is 650 feet long by 250 feet wide by 80 foot high. And just to give you a heads up, this is the fourth floor. Okay, I'm on the top floor. This means I have this much building more underneath me. So everybody says, when you're measuring speakers, are you putting a gate on it? Yeah, if it makes you feel better, I'll put a gate on it. But the facts are, from here to the ceiling is 80 feet. This means it's 160 milliseconds before the sound comes back to this point. Most gates are 40 to 50 milliseconds or 30 milliseconds. I think that 60 milliseconds should be adequate for low frequency, etc. These are also 5 foot deep wedges. So we're not too worried about reflections or anything else. This is what we measure speakers on today. We can measure all the way from 25 hertz all the way to 10K. And because the microphones in here, by the way, there's 19 microphones in here, buried in this thing, every 5 degrees. They're all 4 meters to the center point, plus or minus one sample point at 48K. This gives me phase accuracy at 10K of 10 degrees. Needless to say, I'm not too worried about phase accuracy either. So after encouragement, I open the thing. It's interesting, when you want to do something like this, there is really nothing out there to help you build it. The NSA or the whatever, National Science Council, NSC, they're not interested in basic research. They're interested in doing things out there in AI and stuff like that. But if you want to get into basic research, the first answer I got was NIST no longer has an acoustics area. Now think about this. The National Institute, okay, this is like, what happened to the U.S. anechoic chamber? The one that they had? They got torn down. Okay? Because all the basic research in acoustics had already been done. This is a mature field. There is nothing more to discover. So isn't that interesting to know, right? And this was 25 years ago. So my wife and I dug into our retirement funds, and our retirement funds became NWAA Labs. So we built the entire place out of our own funds with help from a number of people. So these are the people that helped make the laboratory. Anybody familiar with Jerry Lilly? Out of Issaquah, JGL Acoustics. He's probably the finest laboratory designer in the country, by far. Our facilities are the largest reverberation rooms in the world. We have 800 cubic meters as compared to the average room of 200 cubic meters. Because of that, our low frequency limits are 25 hertz instead of 250 hertz. Our noise control products that we isolated this building with are all from Kinetics. Did we do a good job? We are now officially the quietest non-anechoic room in the world. The only people that beat us is Microsoft with their new anechoic chamber. Okay? Our background noise averages minus 17 dB, averages. Our lowest is minus 42 dB. Now, how low is that? Anybody know, did anybody know you can go to minus dBs? Okay, a lot of people don't know this, okay? That the zero is actually a level, okay?
So, I will note that the Brownian motion of air is around plus 6 dB, 20 to 20K for a 1-inch diaphragm.
Brownian motion is an average of minus 23 dB averaged over a weight.
Over a weight?
Yes.
So
now, ours are measured at third octaves.
Okay. If you measure an octave, you get, yeah, because the proper thing is to actually measure ERBs, but we can talk about that offline.
Actually, we have the information. It was all done by Bruin Care, okay, using the same system they did for Microsoft here. So our doors are Krieger. They were specially made for us. They're 14 foot by 8 foot and weigh about 1 ton per leaf. And they're 6 inches thick, and they're an STC 55. Our measurement mics are standard Earthworks M30s for most of our work, which have a background noise of roughly plus 20 dB. Our low field noise microphone is a Bruin Care, and it has an average background noise of minus 10 dB. Our mic preamps are Presonus. Anybody familiar with Presonus? These are the light pipe ones. Okay, only these have been modified pretty drastically. What we found was that the electronics were really, really, really good, but the resistors and capacitors, and especially the rotating, were 25-cent throwaways. So we found that when we first got these 8-channel units, they would drift about one dB per day, which is not too bad, right? Except that we wanted something a lot less than that. So I went back to my old NASA days, and anybody familiar with think about capacitors, resistors, cut film. Try to remember the company that invented them, but they were invented back in the early 60s, and that's what we used on our magnetometers. And I can't remember the name anymore, but we went and bought cut film resistors and capacitors and put them in. Yes?
Ron, are those the original Digimax preamps with the
yes.
external power supplies?
Yes. Yeah, and they really are good. They're really good.
I want to know about that schematic.
Huh?
I'd like to know about that schematic at the mods. But if you can we talk about the mods after the meeting?
Actually, the mods are very simple. We replaced the potentiometer with fixed resistors, film resistors on both sides, and that was it. That's all we did. And we put them in, and they reduced the drift to 1/10 of a dB per month. Okay, and they also reduced the noise by 60%. Okay.
You mean the gain drift?
Huh?
You mean the gain drift? Are you talking about the gain drift when you say the drift?
Yes. Yeah. So the gain drift didn't move more than that much. Okay. All I know is I can set up that arc, calibrate it, and come back a month later, and it'll be within 1/10 of a dB. Okay, and all microphones. And then for the speakers, we originally put in a pair of Real Acoustics Dodex. That was it. But it wasn't adequate for what we wanted to do, transmission loss or anything like that. Dodex, by the way, these Dodex are something that we invented for Real Acoustics for them. They're using Tannoy drivers. And they're about 10% louder than the Brillian Care one is, or the one from Outline, I think it is. And we actually measured it as directivity. It actually has better directivity at high frequencies than any of the other ones do. So they're about $3,000, $3,500, I think, as compared to $6,000 or $7,000 from the other ones. We added a pair of big Brinkus Heinz monsters for the low end. And then for high end, because I needed a lot of high end, I got a hold of Macaulay, and we put in 35 horns, ranging from 4-inch horns to 1-inch horns to 2-inch horns. They're all driven by 40,000 watts of amplifier power, and we reach 142 dB SPL from 25 hertz to 20K, flat within 1 dB, which is not too bad. So this is the AES56 mock testing system for speakers. As you can tell, we do line arrays, etc. And if we want to do 2π, we have a baffle. Again, if you go back to the IEC baffle, they have this offset kind of rectangular thing to average things. This is a round baffle, 12 foot in diameter. Why round? Because the diffraction at the edges is at the same point for every speaker because it's in the center, and therefore all the diffraction occurs at one frequency in one spot, and you can window it. Where if you have it spread over all the other ones, it's spread out all over the place. That's great if you're worried about it spreading, but if you want to get rid of it, that's the way to get rid of it. So we went to a round baffle. So we produced balloons like this for our speakers, GLL directivity. There is a typical frequency response for all 19 microphones at one time, because we can take them we can take care of all 19 microphones simultaneously. And there is a directivity balloon flattened out, and we can produce it in CLF as well. So as time went on, we had to deal with being the only laboratory in the world that did the ISO scattering standard. What we found when we were down at the old laboratory down in California, which had a 200 cubic meter room, is we could make a round table and do all the things it said to do measuring scattering. And we actually got a measurement, and we assumed that was correct based upon following the directions, right? So we then came up here, and we built this large 800 cubic meter room and put the same turntable in, which is, you know, 13 feet in diameter. And we put the same sample there, and we measured it. And the answer we got was completely different. And then we measured it a second time, and a completely different answer the second time. And then a third time, we got a completely different, for the same sample each time. And our first thought was, we're doing the same thing. We have the same sample, the same system, same everything. All we did was put it in a larger room. And what we came to the conclusion was, is ISO 17497-2 and -1 don't work. They were designed using scale models. And the problem is, you can't make a scale model reverb room that is diffuse. They're
so
too small.
Are those measuring a flat piece of something on a surface and then measuring the absorption of it?
That's one of the things they're doing. They're also measuring the return. So you turn it 5 degrees each time, and then you take the answer and you lay it over the top, and wherever it's specular, it adds, and wherever it's random, it subtracts, and you subtract, and you get left with the random stuff, which is the scattering. Okay, so it's all phase function. The only problem is, in small scale models, you can't make a room that's diffuse. And in the standard, it calls for doing it in a reverberation room. Okay, what is a reverberation room? Okay, it's a diffuse room, right? Now, what is the definition of diffuse? You have sound that's evenly spread everywhere, right? But the other thing is, it's also completely phase non-existent because you're mixing phases. You're completely mixing the sound. So how can you measure phase differential in a completely mixed sound field? Can't do it. Okay? You can't separate out the phase when you've already mixed it completely. So therefore, the more reverberant the room became and the more diffuse the room became, the less that you could predict what was going to happen and therefore measure, and therefore the answers you got were completely random. Which is what we proved in our research and stuff. So we've gone back to ISO. We still haven't convinced them of it because their feeling is, well, you know, it was all done with scale models and we've got proof of that. And I'm kind of going, yes, but that's not what happens in the real world. So we decided that if ISO was going to sit on their hands, at ASTM, we were going to invent a new diffusion standard. And we did. And this is the rig for measuring diffusion as well. Look familiar? Okay, what is a diffuser? Or what is let's say a geometric. Okay, let's assume you have a barrel. What is it? It's a speaker without a voice coil. Think about that for a second. It's a speaker without a voice coil. Why? Because if you look up here, there's a speaker up here facing straight down on that unit. Oh, sorry about that. Okay, we're back. So it's bombarding this with sound, and then the first order reflection gets picked up by all the microphones. So it acts like a speaker, first order reflections instead of the original sound. So no voice coil. Voice coil is up here. Now, how can we make it act like a voice coil? Well, you go down here, you take this thing off, and you put a flat panel there. Okay? And now you put a microphone on the flat panel, ground plane. And you measure the frequency response and phase response of the sound at that point, right down here. Now, when you're in something like Speaker Lab, you use it to take the place of the sensitivity, which is the voice coil measurement. Okay, and what does Speaker Lab do, or any of these speaker things do? They take that sound, whatever that is, that frequency response, or that phase response, and they normalize it. And then the rest of the balloon is the losses, or attenuation, from that normalized frequency response and phase response. So if you know what this is, when it arrives here, you can figure out what the attenuation is going up here to all the microphones as long as you take out the original direct sound. So what you see here is an animation, an ease animation, by the way, of the reflectivity of a barrel. This is, you know, a basic simulation using ray tracing only. This is a simulation again of the model. This is an actual measurement of the same barrel. Now, why does it look different? Any ideas, guys? You notice it has a peak. The peak didn't show up in the other one. Think about it.
8 kilohertz is fairly large compared to the size of the barrel.
Yeah, it's very, very tiny, actually. It's only 3/4 of an inch wavelength.
Yeah, but that means it's, so it sees the barrel as flat, essentially.
At one point, at the peak of the barrel. At the peak of the barrel.
Yeah.
So if you look at it from the barrel point of view, if you hit it directly on axis, it's going to come right back at you like a specular reflection. Therefore, you're going to have maximum level and no attenuation. Where as soon as you go off either axis at 8K, it's going to start attenuating like crazy. And that's why there's a peak in the center and it kind of rolls off evenly. But this was something that a lot of people didn't figure happened because sound is too broad to do that. There's a lot of myths out there, I'm sorry, but it's too broad to reflect like a specular reflection off a diffuser. So there's a 3D view of that same barrel. As you can see, it does a nice wide pattern, and it has a center circle, which is basically the specular reflection. And this shows you how wide that unit is, right here. So, our reverb rooms, largest in the world, 737, the quietest anemone, et cetera, at a 10 by 12. So there's a view of our reverb room with a concrete wall in the opening. Now, this is a 10 by 12 foot wall made out of concrete that's 1 foot thick. Okay? The question becomes, how do you get it in there? Because it weighs a lot. I'll let you think about that one for a while, okay? This is one of the things that we had to figure out how to do it. But we also put in windows, which we can test at 25, 10K, STC, transmission loss. We have curtain walls that we test. We have doors, by the way, it's a nice studio door. And we do absorption. Here's an A mount from 40 to 10K. It's an E400 mount. Here's something called a Type M. By the way, this is a brand new mount. This is part of the work that I've been doing. Before, you only had baffles. Now we can actually measure catenaries. So like MBI stuff or kinetics and stuff, this is a brand new mount called the Type M mount. There's a Type J, which you're used to seeing for baffles, except this is something else. If you have never seen these guys, by the way, these come out of Denmark. This is a variable acoustics. You can inflate these things live, and you can change the low frequency absorption by 25% in a room by inflating these things in bubbles. So depending on what frequency you want to absorb, you can inflate a certain pressure into these things. I'm trying to remember the name of the company, Dan something or other, but it's from Denmark. Okay, now we're going to start talking about what our research has done. We'll get back to 9, 10 years ago. How many of you use absorption coefficients in your calculations for RT and stuff? How many know that absorption coefficients don't exist? We're going to talk about that here in a few minutes, because if you have a coefficient, it should be a constant, correct? If you multiply it by the square area, you should get a certain absorption, right? Good. We have a 10-foot by 12-foot sample here. This is the way it's tested normally. Okay? Here's a 10-foot by 12-foot sample. Same area. By theory, it should measure exactly the same, correct?
No, absolutely not.
Oh, really? Why not? Huh?
Wavelength and also the edges. It's got a thickness
to it. Let's talk about the edges. What do the edges do?
They make that coefficient go beyond one.
If you look at the edges, the ASTM standard calls for the edges to be covered by steel.
What sort of steel, though?
Huh?
Is it gaff tape or is it something?
It's steel.
It's steel?
Yeah. They're taped to the floor as far as the edges of the steel. Make sure there's no air underneath them. All ASTM standards are tested with steel.
Okay.
So the edges are not exposed to the sound field in any way at all, only the surfaces. So now let's talk about edge effect. What are we talking about?
I thought the edges were open.
Yeah, they're not.
Okay.
Okay, so, but there is something called edge effect. It has nothing to do with that.
I know about it.
Okay, so what about wavelength? Anything else? Believe it or not, wavelength has little to do with the size of the sample. But let's go a little farther into it and we'll see. Let's talk a little bit about what absorption and wall construction is here. We're going to be going back and forth here. So we're going to be talking about materials versus the walls, frictional absorption versus diaphragmatic, versus a few other things too that we haven't thought about. ASTM mounting methods, wall structure placement, and lack of data. Most of the absorption coefficients you're dealing with, that you deal with in your business, were measured during the 1940s at one frequency. The rest of it was interpolated. Just give you a heads up on all this stuff. Okay? When you go into the books from Beranek or Don Davis or anybody else, they all come from the same sources. And if you actually go back and start searching for the tests, you'll find out they all go back to one frequency at 1K. That's it. There is nothing else tested. Everything else is interpolated based upon what they think is going to happen. Now, to give you an example of how bad this was, 1929, the coefficient of absorption was introduced. Okay, anybody know the name Sabin?
Yeah.
Okay, did you know there were two Sabins? Most people don't know that. Wallace Sabin is the guy who invented everything that we know about absorption. But Paul Sabin invented the coefficient of absorption. Paul Sabin was his nephew, and he's the guy that opened Riverbank Laboratories. Okay, Wallace did not. Okay, people say that all my theory goes against what Sabin said. If you're talking about Wallace, no, because measuring absorption is done with only one possibility of doing it, and that is between an empty room and a full room. Okay, that's it. That's the only way to do it, what the difference is. But converting the amount of absorption, the Sabins, to a coefficient is done mathematically based upon Paul Sabin's idea. But if you go back to the 1929 papers that were presented at ASA, there were two papers presented back to back. One was Paul Sabin introducing the coefficient of absorption, and the other one was by a guy named Chrisley. And if you read his paper, the first paragraph said that Paul Sabin's idea is a bunch of bullshit. And that's exactly how it is stated in the paper. Okay? You have to understand that they were not quite as nice to each other back in 1929 as we are today. He actually called him a bullshit artist. Okay? So this gives you at least an idea how far back this particular argument has been going. And if you go back and look at all the papers in trying to figure out what edge effect is and what absorption coefficient is, there are 1,025 papers since 1929, all of which found exactly what we found, but went from there trying to marry reverberation measurements to impedance tube measurements and why it couldn't be done. Nobody ever bothered to figure out what was wrong with the measurement. So let's talk about how absorption works, how transmission loss works. Energy is lost by rubbing on the filaments of glass. The rubbing slows the movement of air and turns it into heat. That's all. So absorption can be called heat. No matter what you do, it's a conversion of movement of air or something into heat. So if you see an A mount, which is what we're talking about, the sound goes into it, hits the hard surface, and comes back through, and so it travels through the material twice. Okay? Here's diaphragmatic absorption. It moves the panel, goes through the air, and moves the other panel like a drum head. So if you have two drums, if you hit one drum, the other one moves. Okay? That's diaphragmatic absorption. The other part of the diaphragmatic absorption is this. As you move the panel like this, the edges bend. Okay? If you fasten it down, all the bending is done at the edges, right? If you bend anything, right? Anybody ever done this with a piece of metal? What happens to the bend? It gets hot. Okay? You're rubbing the molecules together, and you're absorbing. Okay? Energy. So diaphragmatic absorption. There's a third kind of absorption. It's called resonant absorption. Organ pipes. Anybody familiar with organ pipes? Stop up at one end, you blow air into it, and it goes back and forth between the two stops, right? And as it goes through, it heats up the air from compression to decompression and compression and decompression, etc. If you compress air, you've done it in a cylinder. It happens in diesel engine. That's how you ignite it. Make it compress it to the point, catches fire, right? So those are the three kinds of absorption that are out there. So let's talk here about the absorption. This is a reverberation A mount, okay, which means we took the material, we mounted it on the floor, which is a hard concrete surface, and we're going to measure it just like we did that one, showed this stuff. How many of you use the absorption coefficient of gypsum board in your designs? Walls, right? Anybody build rooms without walls? Okay, so you're all going to use gypsum board, right? If you look at the listings for the coefficient of absorption for 5/8 inch gypboard, you'll find that it's fairly flat, very low, until it reaches the low end, and it goes up. And you get a peak at around 125 hertz or so. So it always seems to have, quote, low frequency diaphragmatic absorption, okay? Everybody's using it. I mean, this is how they control low frequencies, is put gypboard in room and make sure it has air behind it. So we proposed that instead of putting it on the floor, because what happens if you put it on the floor, the sound goes in, diaphragms, goes through, diaphragms, hit that hard concrete, it comes back up through the wall again. Okay, so now it's out of phase, it's going to start interfering with each other and start canceling, and you start getting absorption. Okay, the question is, if you have a wall and it's attached to another room, where does the sound go? It sure as hell doesn't hit that wall to come back. It goes through the wall and into the next room. That's why it's called transmission loss. So therefore, that energy is not coming back at you and not causing out of phase. It's going to the next room and disappearing. So what's really the absorption of that wall? Well, my thoughts were, put it in the opening between the two rooms and measure the absorption. That way, the sound hits that wall, goes through the wall, and into the other room, and disappears. So there you go. This is half-inch gypboard, one layer. If you look at the red one, that is the traditional A mount. And the one below it is the T mount. So you can see there's considerably less absorption at the low end than what we thought. Here we are, half-inch gypboard filled with fiberglass. Same thing. Now look at the low end down there at 50 hertz, 63, 80, and 100 hertz. There's a lot of absorption in the A mount and nothing in the T mount. Here you are with half inch two layer. Same thing. Here we are two layer filled. Here we are with 5/8 inch gypboard.
One of the advantages of having leaky walls is it lets the low frequencies into another space. So essentially, you're losing it. It's not being absorbed, but you're losing it. So you're still getting a loss in low frequency, but it's because it's leaving the room.
That's the point is, it's leaving the room. And that's the point. We have to use this in the room sense when you're building a room. You can't take into account the transmission loss of the room when you're absorbing. So you have to take it out. And that's what I'm trying to tell you, is the standard allows this low frequency to be shown because of the way it's mounted, not because of what it is. Okay, so the A mount is not the correct mount for this. And we're trying to show that. So if you look at the 5/8, you'll notice the gypboard has an average coefficient at all frequencies of 0.05 to 0.01. Okay? There's hardly anything there, which means you really have to look at walls as being solid concrete. okay? Which means you're probably going to have to do a lot more low-frequency treatment than what you planned on. There's one layer filled. Here's two layers. There's two layers. My point is the A mount only simulates a wall built over an exterior wall. So if you have a concrete wall on the exterior and you have an interior wall, that can be done with the A mount, okay, with that low frequency. But any interior wall that's joining to another room should be measured using the T mount. And modeling programs should include both types of data so that you can use those for the different types of walls in order to be more accurate in predicting what your RT of your room is. So now we're going to get to where I started talking earlier about area. You have ASTM C423, ISO 3-4, and ISO 17497-1. These are the three standards that measure absorption. And the funny part is, all three of them give it different answers. Very significantly different answers. So what is sound absorption? A conversion of acoustic energy to thermal energy. What is an absorption coefficient? The result of dividing the amount of absorption by the sampled area. That is a traditional way of doing it. You take the sampled area, you divide it into the amount of absorption, and you get a coefficient. Okay? The problem is that we look at coefficients as being coefficients in the physical sense, which means it's one or less. Okay? One being perfect absorption. And the perfect absorption is modeled by an open window. 423 and 354 require similar shaped samples, which are rectangular. 17497 requires a circular sample. Okay, that's for scattering. They all use different methods of measuring the RT. They use different areas. They have different perimeters. And they all give different answers for the absorption coefficient. And there can be as much as a difference of 25 to 50% difference. So one of the things we decided to do was do a series of experiments. We wanted to experiment by having a similar area, but different shapes, so we had different perimeters. And then we also wanted to do the same perimeter with different areas, see if they had reciprocal answers. So first sample was a circle, 88 square feet. Second one was a square, 88. Rectangle, 88. A long rectangle, 88. And individual pieces, 88. These are all 88 square feet. Okay, they should have the same answer, correct? According to the standard for the calculation of absorption coefficient, right? You guys are nodding yes, no?
No.
You don't think they should have the same answer? Isn't that what absorption coefficient says? Take the amount of absorption and divide it by the area? Okay, here we are with the test with the same perimeter. The perimeter here is 33 feet. 33 feet. 33 feet. 33 feet. Here is material. Anybody familiar with UHD? Okay, this is really heavy stuff. You know, you're used to the MDF, I think it is. This is UDF, basically. Ultra high density. And it's sealed with spar varnish. So basically, you have a steel surface, right? Now, would you expect absorption here?
No.
Or how about here? Any absorption?
I'm going to get diffraction and phase cancellation, I would assume. A little bit.
Nope. My point is, it's the same thing as having a steel plate. You think it's going to have absorption? Is it detectable? Okay. Well, is the edge effect more important than expected? Let's talk about edge effect. Everybody's using the words edge effect. Why? Because they've been doing it for 55 or 60 years now because they can't explain what it is. They say, well, it's being caused by edge effect. And when you ask them to define edge effect, I have not found a single person that can define it. Period. I've talked to people all over AES, all over ASA. Not a single person can define what edge effect is. They just know it's edge effect. Okay? So the question becomes, what is edge effect? What defines it? Nobody knows. We've already gone through this already, but where do we use absorption? This is how we calculate absorption. The volume of the room, decay rate, speed of sound. We measure the room. Okay, we're not measuring the absorption, we're measuring the reverberation of the room is what we're doing. We're measuring how long it takes time to decay. Okay, and that can be done with a strip chart recorder, that can be done with all kinds of balloon popping, all kinds of stuff. You know, measure it, stopwatch, you name it, okay? Speed of sound, where do we use that? We calculate the amount of absorption in an empty room and a full room. We use it, here's our calculation for absorption coefficient, and here's where we use it in. Calculating our T60. So, does the shape of the sample make a difference? Most people have said, if there is an edge effect, at the most, it affects maybe 2 to 3% of the absorption, because it's not very much. This is the samples that have the same area. Those numbers you see on the side are the different perimeters based upon the shape of it, whether it's long or rectangular or circular or in separate pieces. So here we are in the circular, here we are in the square, here we are in the rectangular. These are not very much different because there's not very much of a difference in the perimeter. But now when you go separate it in pieces, look how much more absorption it has. Coefficient goes up to 1.45 from just slightly over 1. This is a 50% increase in absorption. Now, let me ask you a question. 50% more absorption. This is a lot of extra absorption. This is like adding another 50% more material in the room. So does this give you something to think about, that maybe you can get the same effect with less material by changing the shape of it or putting it on the wall in patterns instead of in big pieces? So instead of taking the wall and doing panels that are 4x8 along the whole wall, side by side, like so, you might be able to make 2 foot by 2 foot squares and checkerboard them all around the wall using half as much material and getting twice as much absorption. Now what's really interesting is, here's the absorption of those UDF pieces. Now it's not a lot, 0.1, okay? But there's a fairly healthy amount of absorption in a non-absorptive material. So if the material itself is not absorbing the sound, what is? By the way, here's the same test with the same perimeter in different areas. It looks the same. Now, what's interesting is I presented this paper in 2009 at ASA at Doral, and I was the last guy to present, and a gentleman walked up to the podium as I was finishing up, and he was wearing a lime green jacket with yellow pants. And he walked up with a cane, and he looked like, you know, fairly elderly gentleman. And he says, Mr. Sorrow, he says, I'd like to introduce myself. And I'm kind of going, okay. He says, I'm Leo Baranek. And my first thought was, well, my jaw dropped about here first, okay? That was the first reaction. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and he says, and I'm not dead yet. And I looked at him and I kind of went like this, and he just kind of said, he says, yeah, he said, I know everybody thinks I'm dead because I've been writing books since the 1930s, but he said, I'm not dead yet. And I just looked at him and I thought you were dead, okay? And he said, I looked at your presentation. He said, I came up here to argue with you about everything you came to conclusion with until I got to this chart right here. This is a correlation chart for linear regression of all the data. So if you see all those little dots here, here and here and here, these are all different experiments with different shapes and different amounts of absorption. And we did the linear regressions, and if you'll look at the numbers over here, you'll see that from 160 hertz up, we're at 0.9 and as high as 0.99. Now, if you know anything about linear regression, one is a perfect linear regression. 0.99 is about as close as you can get to it. Which, he looked at that and he says, after looking at that, he says, I can't argue with that. He said, because that tells me that, he says, you have the data that proves what edge effect is. And I said, what do you mean? He says, it's very obvious. He says, it's diffractive. And he says, now the question becomes, what is happening to diffractive energy? And he says, and you've shown it here. He says, this is probably the best work I've seen in 25 years to show what edge effect is. And he says, and I will say this. He said, I want you to write the next chapter for my book on absorption. He said, because of this. He said, you can't argue with this. No matter what you do, there is no argument here. So I felt pretty good about that. And then a few minutes later, I was walking off stage, and another gentleman walked up. That he was probably fairly young looking, I thought, you know. Got to remember, I'm already over 50 myself, okay. He walked up, and he said, I came up to congratulate you on this, the information. I said, really? I said, who are you? And he said, you ever go blank? Anybody ever read the book called Architectural Acoustics? A black and white cover? Okay. And the name, David.
Got a copy of it.
Yeah, we all do, and I know the name too. I can't remember it. But he was a teacher at Clemson, and he taught acoustics at Clemson. And he wrote this book. And I used his book every time I did an E's class. I gave away a copy of this book to every student. Because if you didn't understand what he had to say, you didn't understand basic acoustics. Okay? And he came up and he says, you figured it out. So I felt pretty good about that, especially when I showed him the next part. So, and by the way, what is causing it? Well, this was given to me by a gentleman at SnodCon, one of the members of SnodCon, who got banned, by the way, from SnodCon because of this paper. This paper was written by DeWitt and Burnside about radar waves and edge diffraction, 1960. And what he found was when you had a radar set that shot a beam across the sharp edge of a wedge, it would bend, and when it would bend, the edge of the wedge would melt or burn. So he thought, maybe it's just interaction between, they were metal wedges to begin with, so he changed them to wood wedges. And the wood edges turned black. And then he changed them to fiberglass, and they turned to liquid. And he said, is the radar affecting the material? No, because you had three different materials, they did the same thing. So he figured out what was happening is, as the energy would cross the edge, it would diffract and bend. And in bending, it would heat the air right above the wedge tip. Yes?
So is that way it moves energy after the diffraction? Is it lower energy state? The wave, the microwave.
It was a radar wave, yeah.
The wave moving through space is
diffracted. Yes.
So is the wave, after it's diffracted, have less energy?
Yes.
Yes, so that's the energy.
Right, it gave up the energy to the air, and it heated. And what did we say earlier, that if you have energy that's giving up, what is it?
Well, did it give it up to the air, or did it give it up to...
It's giving up energy. Anytime you convert energy to heat, what is that? It's absorption.
What?
Absorption.
Wow.
Okay. So you can define it as absorption. So now we have frictional absorption, we have diaphragmatic absorption, we have resonant absorption, and now we have a fourth type of absorption that nobody ever knew about before called diffractive absorption. And why is that true? Anybody ever use any RPG diffusers? Okay. Anybody use quadratics? Anybody ever wonder about how they work?
I've gone through the math.
Oh, but let's forget the math. Let's talk about how they physically work.
It didn't make any sense.
Well, let's put it to you this way. It has a lot of little veins inside of it. They have sharp edges, right? The sharp edges are diffractive. Okay? They bend the sound. Therefore, they absorb the sound. Okay? That's why when you measure the absorption of a quadratic, you'll find a significant absorption. It's because of the bending. Okay? Secondarily, the other reason they absorb sound is if you sit there and look at these chambers that are made up with the veins, you notice they're different depths, okay? When sound comes, it has a circuit or a curved edge, right? Anytime a curved edge hits a straight edge, okay, and you have a straight wall, it slows down at the ends where it's hitting the wall, okay? And the center, I guess, pushed back because now you seal the edges with the pressure. Just like you would like a plunger or a hydraulic type thing, a piston. You seal the edges with the air. It goes into the chamber and it flattens out until you have a flat wave or a flat surface. Okay? Now it's sealed and you have a closed chamber of air. And now it's still moving. If it's moving in, what's it doing to the air? Compressing it, right? And what's happened with compressed air? It heats up, gives up energy, and comes bouncing back out of the chamber at different frequencies and different absorption rates. So that's how it absorbs. And that's how it moves sound around. Okay? So, needless to say, you can have the same thing with sound and diffraction. The only problem is it's hard to measure because the amount of energy loss is so low that it's virtually impossible to measure it. So you have to assume that what happens in physics in one spot occurs in another spot the same way. Now, why does a circular sample have less absorption than a square sample with the same perimeter? There's a 20% difference, by the way. So why does the square sample have 20% more absorption than a circular sample, even though they have the same area and basically the same perimeter? Okay, think about this. This is a nice straight edge, right? Okay, if you look at physics, any sound that comes in from any direction, it makes no difference where it comes in from, will always come off of an edge normal to the edge. Okay, if the word normal doesn't hit, 90 degrees. So it's going to come off this edge, this direction, period. So if it comes in this way, it's going to come off this way. If it comes in this way, it's still going to come off this way. So all the edges are all going to have the sound going the same direction. Okay? If it's all going in the same direction, and it all has the same amount of the energy that's coming in versus the energy going out, this indicates that basically it's all the same phase. It has to be. Can't be anything else. Mathematically, it can't change phase if you're all going in the same direction at the same time. It has to do with vector math. Okay? So if this is the case, it's all going in the same way, and it's all headed in the same direction, all this energy is same phase and is coherent. And being coherent, it will be additive, and you'll get additional absorption from it. Okay, now let's say you have a round sample and it comes off the edge. If it comes off the edge at any one point, it's going one direction, right? If it comes off right next to it, it's not going in the same direction because the edge is continuously changing, right? Therefore, all the reflections coming off a circle edge or a curved edge or any kind of curved edge will be non-coherent, and therefore they're not additive, and that's why it has less absorption. So the edges make a big difference in the absorption of materials. So therefore, if you want to design something to absorb a lot of sound, you will create a shape that maximizes the edges as compared to the area. Which the best way of doing that would be a star shape with a lot of peaks and stuff, or a whole lot of narrow strips spaced with spaces in between. So you could have little bars, and then 6-inch space, another bar, and another 6-inch space, etc. And you can do that all along the wall, and you'll probably double the amount of absorption, in spite of the fact that it'll be half as much material. Okay, so based on the results, and this is part of my paper, it's believed that an area-based area absorption coefficient alone is not adequate to describe the total absorption. So we came up with a new formula for doing this. It looks a lot more complicated than it is. Okay? Because this had to do with looking at my charts and going area versus perimeter. So the area of sample 2 minus the area of sample 1 over the perimeter of 2 over the perimeter of 1. These are fairly simple. Okay? It just looks very complicated. So if you want this, I can give this to you, but another way of doing it is right there. Okay? So there's the total absorption formula. So if anybody ever wants a copy of this, I'd be happy to give this to them. But it has, you just have to know what the area is and what the perimeter is that you're measuring of two different samples, and then calculate it from there. And it's a fairly simple calculation. And you end up with basically an area, not a coefficient, but an area constant. Here we are. We've been beating absorption coefficients and absorption like a dead horse for umpteen years. Okay? So if you look over here, you will see, I've said it 1,000 times, use the whisk. I hate to beat a dead horse, but it's our job. Okay? A coefficient is not a percentage. Please understand this. 0.9 is not 90% absorption. It is a coefficient. Okay? So 0.9 absorbs 5 to 6 dB of sound. That's it. That's all it absorbs. 0.99 picks it up to 2 more dB. 0.999 takes it up 3 dB. So the best you can get out of this thing is if you have an absorber that has a coefficient of 0.999, which is something that's around 8 inches thick and very soft. If you put it on the front face of a balcony and you have a speaker out here at 90 dB, it's going to give you a reflection back in your face of about 80 dB. Now, I have to ask you, can you hear an 80 dB reflection? So what makes you think 8 inches of absorption is going to help you on the balcony face?
It's better than 90.
Well, it is, but you might be better off to take the balcony face and tilt it upward a little bit and put the reflection up on the ceiling instead of coming back at you. You'll get better results than you would by 8 inches of absorption on the face.
And add some dispersion, please.
Huh?
And add some dispersion, please.
Yes. Yes, another way of doing that. So let me do this one more time. We're going to beat a dead horse here. It is not a percentage. Please, 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 don't tell me.
What is the formula for coefficients of absorption?
The amount of absorption on a surface divided by the area.
Okay.
Okay, it has nothing to do with the amount of sound.
Okay.
Okay? So it is not a percentage, and I hear that, I see that in articles, in the magazines like Mix Magazine and all the other ones. I mean, I read this all the time, and I'm sitting there going, you wanted to beat the guy. Yes.
So earlier you were talking about the normal coming off the edge that's straight and et cetera. So if you took the face of the balcony and you did wedges, then the reflection would no longer be coherent. So would that?
Hold it. You made one small problem.
Okay,
reflections are coherent. The edge is not, but the face of the wedge is. It's a specular reflection. If you come off the face of the wedge, okay, either side of the wedge, that's a coherent specular reflection.
But not necessarily back toward the stage.
That's exactly it. But it's still a coherent reflection, which is still not good. Yeah, the problem is if you put a whole bunch of wedges, at some point they're going to be this way, and they're going to start adding in the center. So keep in mind that here you're doing this, but in between, yeah, you're going to have weird things going on.
An erratic reflection at some listening point.
Yeah, a better way of doing that is with a vertical barrel function. So the sound goes up and forward and reduces it by. Right. Right. Yeah. And the better part of doing that is treat the ceiling and then reflect everything up in the ceiling. Okay, that way it doesn't come back at you. And you also have a lot more distance to absorb sound. Okay. So, myth. Acoustics is a settled branch of physics. We got fundamental research going on today. Absorption is as fundamental as you can get. Okay, if we can't get that straight, how in the hell are we going to get anything else right? We can measure absorption. This is another myth. We do not measure absorption. We measure the room results of absorption, and we infer absorption from it. But there is no physical way of measuring absorption. Yes?
Could you measure the temperature rise in a material that is being...
No. It's too small in sound. If you're doing radar, yes. But when you're talking about the amount of energy in a room, there's no discernible difference that's really measurable. Yes?
So if you're hanging the panel in your open window, essentially, and you're directing sound at the panel,
yeah,
and you know the level of the sound on the face where you're generating it, can't you just measure the level of the sound on the other side of the panel?
No, that's transmission loss.
And the difference...
Difference is not absorption. There is no direct conversion for transmission loss to absorption.
There's no.
I wish it did. It would make my job a lot easier.
Well, transmission is going to give you the amount that got through, but that doesn't mean account for the amount that got lost, either going through or coming back. So you're missing a term there.
So you can measure on both sides of the room and then figure out your transmissions and your absorption.
Well, you can't measure the absorption because that's not going to. But you can measure how much energy goes through the wall. That's what transmission loss is.
Yeah.
Okay. This one here, absorption is controlled by the size area of the absorber. It's not true at all. Previous presentations have shown this to be the case. The ratio of perimeter length to area is a controlling factor. This was the case up until last year. So, mind you, we discovered this part of it, and we've been beating on it and working on it for all these years. This last year. We came up with this. The spacing of the absorption is also a controlling factor. So here we did a series of experiments again. Okay, we have the monolithic. We have a space. These are 2 foot squares. They're spaced 6 inches, 12 inches, 18 inches, and 24 inches. Monolithic is the blue one at the bottom. 18 and 24 are the top ones. So what this tells me is this. When the spacing approaches the size of the sample, you can no longer increase the absorption. So if you have a 2 foot sample and you space it between 18 and 24 inches apart, That's the maximizing the amount of absorption. And this is on top of the size of the sample and the perimeter.
So that's a purely empirical conclusion.
Here it is.
It is because it is.
It is because it is.
You don't have any explanation for it physically.
Yeah, it's wavelength related. Yeah. Because you notice it picks up at certain frequencies. Now, the other thing I can tell you is, and I didn't show you this because I had to reduce some of this stuff, is when we measured 1-inch material and we got the hump at 1,200 hertz. When we measured 2-inch material, we got the hump at 600 hertz. Measured 4-inch material, we got the hump at 300 hertz. So we can take whatever it is we measure and assume that if you double the thickness of it, you'll move the hump one octave down each time. Now what's interesting is the hump doesn't change shape and doesn't change width either. Yeah, the other absorption we did, it showed the hump going up, and it had the center at 600, and then it came back together at both ends. It does the same thing, except it does it 600 and does it 300. But the width doesn't change, the Q doesn't change, the shape of it doesn't change. All that happens is the frequency at the center moves down. So therefore, empirically, you can assume that as you double the thickness of the material, you'll reduce the peak by one octave each time.
Is there any energy loss that occurs at the interface between the air and the material? Is that what's causing the dependence on wavelength?
No. No. There's actually a presentation that if I have time, I'll go into it. It was presented by Bob Hallman, who's the chief scientist at Armstrong. He's the one that came up with this spacing situation. And then he left it to me to figure out what that spacing situation was. So now we're trying to figure out how to put it into a formula using the spacing and the perimeter area and put it in so it's wavelength dependent, so we can sit there and say if you don't exceed this number of spacing, then you will get no increase, but you'll get an increase based upon this function. So that's still being done. This has all happened within the last 6 months. Okay, so that's the latest information on absorption. Now, what's interesting is this. In all the standards, it says you shall not make the sample be parallel to any of the walls. In other words, the edges of the sample shall not be parallel to any walls because that will affect the absorption. Okay? That's in the standard. It's all over the place for every kind of absorption measurement there is. So I decided, you never give a consultant his own laboratory, because there is an unlimited amount of questions you can ask that people have been asking for years and nobody ever answered because it costs money. Okay, so here is an experiment showing samples that are parallel to the walls and also unparallel to the walls. So 24-inch aligned with the walls and unaligned with the walls. Thought that would interest you. By the way, these measurements were taken about 2 hours apart. Okay, so then we went to 18-inch aligned versus unaligned.
What's the red curve?
That's the unaligned one. Here's 12-inch. Now, the small amount of changes you see here are what we call measurement allowances. There's that much of a change in the air temperature or the humidity that make that much of a difference. So those are virtually identical as far as we're concerned. Okay, how many of you put baffles in rooms and assume that because it has two sides, it'll double the absorption? Yeah, well, hate to tell you guys, baffles have about 1.2 to 1.3 times their original absorption. If you measure them on the floor versus hanging them, just because you have two sides doesn't mean you're going to double the absorption. And here's the reason for that. If you put them on the ground, The sound goes in, hits the surface, and comes back out, goes through the material twice. Right? If it's hanging in midair, the sound goes in one side, comes out the other side, and never goes through the second time. So therefore, you have less absorption. Okay, and sometimes you'll get an additional amount of reflection off the one next to it or something, and that's why it's 1.2 to 1.3. Okay.
Wouldn't that vary a little bit for base absorption if you actually plop the thing in a mode, in a node versus say?
Yeah, it part of it could be modes, but it seems to be an average overall also. Now, this is the one that I get a lot of kicks out of. Oh yeah, we got to arrange them in parallel, boxed, herringbone, and all the other things. None of it makes any difference to the absorption. You can hang them randomly, you can hang them any way you want to, and all these patterns that are being calculated because they do this and do that is bullshit. Okay, that's the best way of putting it. These are myths. The spacing between, remember we talked about the spacing? The spacing here makes a difference. So if you take a 2x4 and you put it 2 feet by 4 feet, depending on which way you put it on the end or off of it, you can increase your absorption. But anything beyond that makes no difference. This is another one. Wall-mounted panels that are spaced off the wall will increase our low-frequency absorption. How many of you take panels and put a block behind them, 2-inch block or a 1-inch block or something like that, and assume it absorbs a low frequency absorption? Yep. Well, this is only partially true. Low frequency absorption only increases when the wall spacing does not exceed 1 inch. As soon as you exceed 1 inch, the low frequency effect disappears completely. So this is just as good as putting it on the wall. So if you go 2 inches away, you might as well put it on the wall because that's the same effect you're gonna get. So if you put a 1 inch off the wall or 3/4 inch, you'll get a slight increase in low frequency, but a very slight one, probably about a 4 or 5% difference. Okay, last part. Is it that time already? God.
Did you want to take a break at some point? Up to you.
Yeah, this is a good place to do it. We're gonna take a quick break, guys. I'm surprised I lasted this long.